You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I think everybody here is familiar with the term big oil. You're probably also very familiar with the term big defense. And lately, particularly in the last few weeks with the Medicaid reform, increasingly the term big pharma. These are all representative of small groups of mega corporations who dominate their particular sector, both economically, and they also hold the key to the political leverage that we see relating to policy in each of their arena. I think the group here represents a position where we want to add two more to this list. The first is big media. You might even have heard that term before, but maybe we can put it a little bit more into use, which includes a half a dozen conglomerates that basically own everything right now, from network television, broadcast stations, and cable systems, to theme parks, sports teams, and concert venues. We also have a parallel but probably slightly less visible entity, which I couldn't quite think of the right term, but I'm calling big technology. And this is where our concept of media, which primarily has focused up until now on content, and we'll be hearing a lot about that in a few minutes, but there's been a seismic shift in what's happened in the last decade to refocus issues relating to media onto the systems of distribution. Not solely the content, but the distribution, how we actually get the content in our homes, which also has a tremendous amount to do with policy, not just the airwaves, which I think all of us are familiar with, but cable, wireless, and other spectrum infrastructure, and the digital code that allows us to exploit that infrastructure. So we're proposing incorporating big media and big technology into these other framework of major corporate industry that has a tremendous amount to do with how our policy is being established today. It's not that the old media has gone away, but that new media, including internet communications, has really exploded to create a new media environment, and this is the environment that we're all facing now. So I want to give you a little bit of an introduction to what you might be familiar with that I'm calling here big media. If you'll please roll the videotape.
Westinghouse and good old GE.
They own networks from CBS to CNBC.
They can use them to say whatever they please and put down the opinions of anyone who disagrees.
Or stuff about PCBs.
What are PCBs?
They come from electric power plants built by Westinghouse and GE.
They can give you lots of cancer that can hurt your body.
But on network TV, you rarely hear anything bad about the nuclear industry.
Like when Westinghouse was sued for fraud?
Which time?
GE made defective bolts, it was an unreported crime. Or when it was boycotted for operating nuclear bomb plants just to squeeze a dime.
That's a footnote, by the way.
A footnote protects you from folks who doubt what you say. Now maybe the voices in my head will go away.
But the big shots don't care, they're all sitting pretty thanks to corporate welfare.
What's that now?
They get billions in subsidies from the government. It's supposed to create jobs, but that's not how it's spent. They use tax and soft money to support congressmen who will vote for weapons programs again and again.
bullets that shot JFK.
You contribute to this chain every time you buy a product sponsored on this show.
That's what NBC doesn't want you to know. So the next time, please stand by.
Does anybody know what this is? Just raise your hand if you know. We got just a couple. Any of you ever actually remember seeing this on television? One person saw this on TV. This is called Mediaopoly, 2.5-minute animation by Robert Smigel. You've probably seen his work if you watch Saturday Night Live at all. He's been on for 10 years. This is a couple of years old. It was aired exactly once on Saturday Night Live. And as soon as they saw what it was, NBC pulled this animation, never to be seen again on any reruns of Saturday Night Live or anywhere else. And you could tell by the topic what this is really about. And this is from a few years ago. This is a question of the control of big media. Not just controlling its own media, and not just being tied to a lot of other non-media industries, but also having a stranglehold over the kind of messages and content that we're actually able to look at the same time that they have, as they showed here, you know, all of these big corporate tentacles looking in these other areas. I thought it was very brave of Robert Smigel to actually do this animation, and you can tell what happened to it. Now it's, you know, basically a pirate on the internet. But I thought that this was a really appropriate introduction to the question of where media is at today and our exposure to it. The pervasive and insidious nature of corporate media is reframing issues across the board, from foreign policy and international relations to economics, education, healthcare, the environment, civil rights, employment, culture, you name it. And of course, now we also have major foreign policy issues and a war that's going on. Representation of women, poor people, immigrants, and local voices have been especially absent or dismissed in the world of concentrated media ownership. But these days, knowing how media messages are shaped is very important. It's required for us to know how media gets on the air. Supporting the production and distribution of independent media production is absolutely critical in this kind of an environment. I can't say enough about it. But it is not enough. If we want to change the way that media functions, we also have to understand how it's distributed, who owns it, and the huge amount of money that it controls. And if we have the stamina, we should also try to comprehend the impact of the shifts in technology, changes in the regulatory structures, which have been radical, and the aggressive spread of privatized media and telecommunications systems, how it's altering our culture and around the world. As we sit here today, there's actually a major international meeting that's going on in Geneva called the World Summit on Information Technology and Systems. And there's a major alternative summit that's going on at the same time, which has to do with exactly this, which is challenging the concept of privatized and corporate media in global control and trying to show that this really should be something brought back into a local level in the context of human rights. Despite this, there's a great deal of energy and activism that's challenging and transforming media. There are a growing number of groups that are working on a wide range of issues addressing these and dozens of other aspects of the media landscape. Every day, more people are getting involved. Notably is the groundswell of public involvement and resistance to the recent FCC efforts to relax existing media ownership rules, and the growing inclusion of media as a key issue with social justice groups, especially anti-war and anti-globalization organizers. There are three basic media organizing strategies that activists use when they're engaging in any area of media activity. The first is creating and operating independent media production and distribution. I mentioned that just a minute ago. It's really critical for us to understand how much independent media actually exists, how strong it is, how it's growing stronger, and how critical it is for us as funders and activists to support the continued evolution of independent media. And it is under attack. I'm saying that because this is not a given at all. We'll be hearing quite a bit more about independent media in a couple minutes. The second is using, understanding, and confronting corporate media. We can't escape the impact of corporate media, but there are a lot of people who feel like we can engage in it, just like people have engaged big oil around policies of a lot of the oil producers, just like they're taking on big pharma and a lot of the issues relating to distribution and economics of international drug supply, I mean legal drug supply. There are also groups that are taking on big media and big technology and dealing with how to use them in ways that are positive and to make them accountable to us. You saw the thing on corporate welfare. It's the same thing. There are some levels of accountability that we can make, and we'll hear a little bit about that too. And the third strategy is changing the underlying structures, policies, and regulatory framework for how this stuff works. And this is probably one of the hardest areas for a lot of people to understand, but in fact, because of the proposed changes in the FCC rules, it's one that's actually getting a little bit more attention now. And it's also very important, because this stuff doesn't just happen out of thin air. It happens because there are policies in place that allow it to happen and which we can change. We have the power to change some of that. We have a really outstanding panel here today who are going to be able to speak about a number of these issues. And first, I want to just send some apologies. Arianna Huffington is not here. You probably figured that out. She had a conflict which made it impossible for her to join us this morning. And Joan Shigekawa from the Rockefeller Foundation also, she had a slight accident in New York and she was not able to travel either. And fortunately, we've asked a couple of other women to join us instead, so I feel like we also have a completely outstanding group. One of the speakers who has agreed at the last minute to join us this morning is Sally Jo Pfeiffer. Sally is the CEO of the Independent Television Service. She's been there for a couple of years. And before she took the helm at ITVS, she spent 9 years as the executive director of the Bay Area Video Coalition. Some of you may be familiar with BAVAC. We also have on the panel Katie Chevigny, who is one of the founders and organizers of MediaRights.org, a nonprofit organization that helps media makers, educators, librarians, nonprofit groups, youths, and activists use documentaries to encourage action and dialogue on social issues. Also on our panel today is Malkia Cyril. She's the director of the Youth Media Council here in the East Bay, and she's worked with low-income youth and communities of color as an organizer for the past 9 years, including groups such as the Applied Research Center, the Alameda County Homeless Youth Collaborative, Community Organizing Team of BOSS, the Youth Force Coalition, Uniting Communities Against War and Racism, and We Interrupt This Message, which is also an organization that some of you may be familiar with. And finally, we're really pleased to have with us, kind of the last minute, and not least, but and absolutely not last, Joan Blades, who is the co-founder of MoveOn.org, a political action website dedicated to promoting broad public participation on political discourse. Each of these women will be speaking at length about some of these issues, and we're really honored to have everyone here to be speaking about media as it exists today. So I just wanted to mention very briefly what the trends of in some of these issues are right now. The first is one that has already come up in my remarks, and that is that there's a spotlight that's starting to shine on policy and regulatory issues, partially because of the really, I think, unsatisfactory coverage that a lot of the media has given to Bush's policies, particularly the war, but not exclusively the war, a lot of his domestic policies as well. And I think we've seen, even with groups like MoveOn.org and others, there's a consistent effort to try and expose the lies of the Bush administration and to have the media be much more accountable even for reporting to us what's really going on. There's also a lot of anger because of the recent FCC rulemaking that allowed more media consolidation. We've seen that taken up in Congress. They're fighting about it now. It's really been because of a number of small grassroots groups that the courts themselves ordered the FCC to freeze their own rules and to encourage more participation in examining what the impact of these rules are really going to be on our own local communities, instead of just assuming that Michael Powell, who's the head of the FCC and the son of Colin Powell, can just do whatever he wants. He doesn't even believe that the FCC should be a regulatory body. The third is that there's more attention that's actually going to independent media. We've seen a real rise in the importance of independent television and also independent radio, particularly with groups like Democracy Now!, Free Speech TV, WorldLink, some of the groups that are doing both satellite and television, and also a rise in radio, and the success of low-power radio in getting hundreds of new stations on the air in local communities who can do real local voice. In the immediate future, we're going to see a focus on the elections. This is a short-term strategy, but one I think we're already seeing the impact of, both in terms of issue ads as well as candidate ads. And I think there was just a court ruling yesterday about campaign financing and how they have to act, that they actually can keep the restrictions in the campaign finance laws. So we're going to see whether that has an impact on broadcasting. And we're also looking at the consolidation of the regulatory issues. After the Telecommunications Act of 1996, our regulatory framework for how media and technology were controlled in terms of our government policies was radically, radically changed. It was kind of lost in a lot of other news that was going on, but we're really seeing the impact of that now. And a lot of people are realizing that we have to do something to address the underlying policy issues and trying to speak to how we could do things, not just to keep consolidation from continuing to steamroller, but also to protect the few areas that we have under our control already, because they are under attack. One of the things that's going on right now, and I think it's a local issue, is public access channels. Many of the cable companies are getting refranchised. They're asking their municipal governments, where they get their permission to operate, to give back the municipal channels and the public access channels so that those channels will no longer exist, and they're meeting with some success. This is the kind of thing that's going on right now, and a lot of it is because of the result of a huge government overhaul in 1996. And here it is, coming home to roost. So the final thing I just want to remark on here is kind of the role of funders. And unfortunately, the role of funders isn't as good as it could be. The sector in media, and I use that in the broad term to include technology, interactive issues, and telecommunications, as well as broadcasting, et cetera, this sector is seriously, seriously underfunded. There hasn't been a lot of money that's gone into media up until now. It's been a relatively small group of funders, even though they've been consistent, some small and some large. But as a major sector, having social impact on all of us, it's been an area that really has been underfunded in a serious fashion. We're hoping that some of you will get inspired to do something more about it, not just in your own organization, but also to work with other funders about this, because we're seeing what it means for us to not have the resources to really do the work. We are also finding that a lot of funders are actually beginning to realize that media has become a critical issue. Up until recently, I think foundations and individual donors might think, like, well, it's really not important. But it's beginning to have such an impact on other social issues that it can't be ignored. So foundations and donors and individuals and people involved in investments, et cetera, are actually really looking to find out more about media issues, and they want to be educated. And I think this forum this morning is actually a really good example of how much interest there is in this. We hope we can continue to encourage more education. Funders, by and large, are not really clear about these political strategies. It's not like offering social services or some of the other political issues that foundations might be involved in, where there's a kind of a clear sense of what the strategies are trying to accomplish. In the media area, the strategies are not so clear. We're hoping with these kinds of educational presentations, people will get a better sense of the strategies that are working and why people are following them, and also get inspired to do some more strategic thinking about their own impact and what it means, because there are strategies that media organizers use, and we'll be able to hear specifics about them. And the last thing I just wanted to mention on this is that as I've run through kind of the whole expanded area of what means to be involved with media and telecommunications right now, is that foundation and donor funding is just simply not caught up at all to the rapid changes in the media environment. I'm not offering this as a critique, that things are happening in this field very, very quickly, but it makes that piece of education all the more important, because even us who are involved in it have a really hard time knowing what's going on and how to catch up with it. And with funders who have particular kind of structures and, you know, need to take into consideration, things are moving very, very rapidly, and we're hoping that there'll be some ability to be more flexible and perhaps a little bit more agile in responding to some of these needs as they come up, because they're happening extremely rapidly. None of us can predict their impact. But it would be nice for us to know that the foundations are paying attention and trying to help respond to these issues, because they have such an impact on us all. So at this point, I am going to ask Sally Jo to come on up. Here, I'm going to turn things over to the panel. And you'll get a chance to hear firsthand on some of the specifics in the areas that I've just tried to outline very briefly for you. Sally Jo.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, it's stating the obvious after listening to Nan that media is an enormously powerful tool for us in the 21st century in the nonprofit sector, but it's overwhelming sitting next to our pals in the profit sector. 73% of our economy is now fueled by retail. And just in the fall lineup alone on the networks, corporations spent $9.4 billion just in advertising. So I read this goofy little story on my way back, actually home on this last trip from the East Coast, about this this 80-year-old woman who started a company 50 years ago making a product called Frownies. The women in the audience will probably recognize this because it's always a little classified ad in the back of women's magazines, and it's an adhesive strip that you get to put on your forehead, and overnight, instantly, your frowns disappear. I've been looking at this product now for about the last 5 years, contemplating the purchase, but visions of Gloria Swanson and Sunset Boulevard have prevented me from actually buying it. But it didn't prevent Rene Russo from making the purchase, and she extolled its virtues in a good housekeeping article a couple of months ago. And this little 80-year-old woman's revenues have now gone from $40,000 a month to millions of dollars a year. So it's a pretty amazing thing what media can do. And I don't think anybody who works in the nonprofit sector as funders question that media isn't an important strategy, but what we do question is how are we going to do it well? And since I'm trying to fill Joan's shoes, 10 years ago, I remember going to see her, and of course, when I was more in the business of getting than giving, asking her for stuff, and she said, "Well, how am I going to know, Sally, if I fund this media project, then I'm not just throwing confetti into the Grand Canyon?" Well, of course, that stopped me cold. But how do I know at ITVS, which funds independent productions for public television, that if I fund a program called Two Towns of Jasper, that it's going to actually win the Columbia Journalism Award? That Ted Koppel's going to interview the filmmakers, that ITVS's Community Connections program is going to be able to show this this documentary about hate crime to the Utah State Legislature, which didn't vote for a hate crime bill three times in a row. And after watching this film, they actually voted resoundingly for this hate crime bill in the state of Utah. How am I going to know to fund that program versus all the other things coming my way? Well, you know, I wish I had an easy answer, but it's really like anything else that we're investing in or you're investing in. It's study, it's practice, it's learning from lots of mistakes, you know, but essentially it's doing it. And looking back, I think philanthropy has done not a bad job with two major strategies over the years. The first is what Anand is talking about, which is funding media reform and policy so that we can make the commercial media basically behave, to step up to the public interest, because we own those airwaves as citizens, and they ought to do it. The second strategy, though, which I think has been probably, you know, an incredibly powerful thing over the last 35, 40 years, is to fund a public media ecology. And that that has been an amazing effort on behalf of philanthropy and the organizations that have participated. And ITVS is one of those. Independent, and I guess what I'm talking about, are the media art centers that surround a distribution of public radio and public television, independent producers who are sort of the worker bees, the content makers, the messengers that work on behalf of the nonprofit sector on issues like poverty and environment, all those things. This ecology creates a way to inform and enlighten citizens. And ITVS and other organizations within this sort of self-generating ecology actually step up and find other ways to bring money to the table. And just as an example, ITVS was the result of independents hounding Congress for about a decade, and eventually getting Congress to write in the report language and force the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds public television, to set aside a fund, a $10 million fund, for independent productions, for these kinds of programs that independents make and then get out to the community for the civic engagement campaigns that I talked about with Two Towns of Jasper. And they funded and public television, which is now, believe it or not, a $2.1 billion business, funded about 16% by the federal government, but mostly in local stations, each, you know, raise the money matching all of those dollars. That's not a bad strategy. And looking back 30 years ago, you think, well, that's, you know, it seems pretty smart to make a fourth network against all these other commercial networks. Not a bad thing to do. Today, though, the landscape is so complex and so radically changed and confusing when we have all these diverse gadgets and images and data coming at us from all these different distribution channels. The question for us as or for you as funders, I guess me too, is how do we fund effectively in this new competitive environment? And I don't think that the question is that we hold a media exempt from doing its job in the marketplace. We know, as correctors of the marketplace, since we're working in the nonprofit sector, that media isn't correcting the marketplace, that we've got to make it do it. But how do we do it? And I think it's helpful if we look a little bit at where the audiences are going. What we're trying to find in audiences are citizens, not consumers. And where can we find those citizens that we can inform, enlighten, engage in the kind of work that we're doing? So I'm going to just mention and then close three trends where the audiences are going, because I think it's kind of interesting. The first trend is that audiences or our citizens are disaggregating. There's 105 million households. 80 million of those households are cable. Another 20 million are digital cable, and another 20 million are satellite. The net result of that is that there's hundreds of channels. Digital cable, interestingly enough, Nan and I were talking about it earlier, has a really high churn rate. It turns out that people really don't want all of those channels. It's kind of like water everywhere, not a drop to drink. And if you stayed in a hotel and dislocated your thumb, you know that that's what's going on there. So people aren't really signing up for hundreds and hundreds of channels. But The idea is that these niche audiences are forming on broadcast television. Networks are getting somewhere between 5 and 12 million people, which isn't to say that sometimes there's not more or less. Public television is interesting. In the ranking, it's about 6. It's at about 2 million people. Everybody else is more or less below that. Like CNN is 900,000 people. The Sundance Channel is 20,000 people. MTV is about 900,000 people. So what's happening is these niche audiences are not really a bad thing for our sector, because that's how we've been working for years. We work on environmental issues, poverty issues, actually trying to use the idea of filtering and aggregating these audience for us is not a bad thing. The question is for us, and I think Nan brought this up, is that out of all these hundreds of channels, how many of them are public? And out of how many of these hundreds of channels are these folks actually buying independent work that you've publicly funded? Well, the answer to that is slim on both counts. The cable stations are working, you know, quick and dirty in kind of formulaic programming. They don't acquire very much programming from independents on the whole. And if you want to compare, say, something like HBO, which buys 30 documentaries a year, or public television, which shows 950 documentaries a year in its system, I mean, the numbers sort of show what's happening there. The other thing is that public television is working really hard right now to try to get, as the digital environment allows them to multicast and have different digital channels, get the cable networks to actually put the rest of their channels on, and they're not doing it because there's not a must-carry rule in the government. It doesn't, you know, it's an issue. So what Nan is talking about is really critical about, this kind of myth that somehow, because we've got all these diverse gadgets and channels, are there actually access roads for independent producers and for public media makers and for the nonprofit sector? The answer is, is the jury's out. The second trend is that people are watching anytime, any place, kind of thing. And this has been foreshadowed with DVD players, which there's now 50 million of them out there, and of course home video and stuff. And then there's these new products like TiVo, which are digital video recorders, where you can record programming off the air and watch it anytime you want, and basically fast forward over your commercials. There's 2 million of those out there, and the satellite channels have now got set-top boxes where you can sort it not quite as robustly, but do the same thing. And there's 10 million video on demand homes out there, meaning that the capacity so that you can bring in programs when you want to watch it and basically do what you want with the program, we're moving in that direction. Forrester Research says in 3 years that 30% of homes will have these kind of TiVo-like recording devices, and 30% of the homes will have video on demand. So this is something that's moving pretty fast, and this idea of Googling your television set is a cataclysmic, really, thing for the broadcast industry. This is probably where you've heard how the for-profit sector is trying to manage this business model in this new environment, and words like advertainment and product integration and branded entertainment is the latest thing of how they're trying to sort this out. The third trend, and we've been watching this and hearing about it for years and years, and it's moving fairly slowly, is this interactive or enhanced television. And, you know, DVDs are showing us that people like to have a more robust media environment. We know that 18 to 24-year-olds are big multitaskers. They want to be talking on the phone and watching TV and doing their email and, you know, being on the internet at the same time. And 48%, when queried, say that they can't live without their television, but 70% say that they can't live without the internet. So we sort of know what's coming ahead. I think I'll close by saying that the job out there for us in the nonprofit sector and for funders in the nonprofit sector is to find our citizens, to aggregate those audiences and be able to get to them with the good work that we're doing. As the for-profit sector is trying to figure out those business models for this new technology, and I've just mentioned and focused on broadcast technologies, and the panel will tell you in much more expanded stories, but as they're doing that, you know we've got to be doing it. We have got to figure out how we're going to be using these new technologies, and we've got to make sure that we have the access roads and the capacity to even be using them. And that means we got to be in the conversation, like Nan says, about setting the rules and making sure the playing field's level. I'll close by saying, or end by saying, that Joan funded two projects I think that you would find interesting, and I know that she would mention if she were here. At the end of January, there's a conference called Digital Indies, which talks will have a host of people talking about all of these issues and also some of the newer technologies, too, and I think it'll be interesting. And you can find out about that conference and who's going to be there at digitalindies.org. And the second thing that Joan has funded, which is going to be interesting, I think, is a project having the global business networks, and these are the guys who do scenario planning, look at where the future of independence in the next decade and longer out. This project will probably come to the Council of Foundations, and we have somebody in the audience, NAMAC, Helen DeMichel, who's the executive director, who can tell you about it. And this will be using the client base of the Bay Area media organizations that you fund as the group who's going to help global networks do that. So I guess I'll end there since I'm probably, am I on time? Thank you.
Hello, Tech. Oh, okay. thank you, Sally Jo. I'm going to ask that Katie Chevenier with MediaRights.org. I also just wanted to make clear that Sally was talking about Joan Shigekawa with the Rockefeller Foundation, who was not able to join us today. And I think there are going to be some details about this Digital Indies Conference, which is coming up in February?
End of
January, so we'll have details about that. It is going to be here in San Francisco. Okay, we're getting booted up here.
Yeah, I'm actually going to show something in a minute. First, I'll just tell you a little bit about what I've got here. Sure. How's that? Thanks very much for coming and listening. My name's Katie Chevney, and I'm a social issue documentary filmmaker. And later, after I made several films with my partner, Julia Pimsler, in our company, Big Mouth Productions, which is based in New York, over the years, we became more and more concerned about the issue of distribution and outreach of documentary films, not just the making of independent media. And as a result of our concern and thinking about that, we started this organization called MediaRights.org in 1999. So I just wanted to give you a little background, and I think it's sort of a good segue from what Sally Jo was talking about, because we're very interested in the people who fund so-called, I guess now, traditional media, which is documentary film, which is my first love. But there's just no way to get around the political realities of the problems of distribution, and we felt committed to addressing that as well. There's sort of a genesis story of how Media Rights got started, which I think you all might appreciate it. There was one of our documentaries. You all might appreciate it. There was one of our documentaries about criminal justice was funded by the Ford Foundation. And in 99 or 98, I think it's early 99, one of the program officers at Ford set up a meeting of a bunch of social issue documentary filmmakers, as well as a bunch of nonprofits and activists who were working on some of the issues those films were about. And they basically set up the meeting and said, why aren't you guys working together more? You know, it's Ford Foundation. They got a lot of money. They spend a lot of money on the films. They spend a lot of money on the activists, and they felt like maybe there wasn't enough connection. Their money wasn't going far enough. And Julia Pimsler, my partner, was there, and it was a fascinating conversation. At the end, she said, well, I think this is a really big problem, and all of us, it's hard for all of us to get into a room like this if you hadn't brought us together. And I think maybe the Ford Foundation should have a website where filmmakers and activists could get together. And the Ford Foundation said, well, we're not going to do that with the Ford Foundation, but you can do that. And so that sort of sparked the idea, and we started talking about what would be a way to sort of make that relationship work better. And that's the core of what we're trying to do. There's many different ways to use media to mobilize people to take action and to try to make a difference and sort of see the connections between the things they're seeing in the film they're watching, their documentary they're watching, and how it connects to their life and their sense of civic engagement. And we by no means are the last word on that. And we didn't want to even say to people, this is how you should do that. It was more that there's so many people doing great things on that we wanted to find a way for people to learn from each other and learn from each other's mistakes. So what we did with Media Rights was, first thing we did was we said, one of the problems we know as independent filmmakers is that independent media is very fragmented. It's sort of the opposite of the problem that Nan was talking about with media conglomerates that are very centralized and they run everything from the funding to the distribution. Independent media has the opposite problem, which is, I mean, there's a benefit to being independent because you're independent, which means creatively and politically that's a very good thing. It becomes a more difficult thing when it comes to distribution because then you're not linked to all the power networks that big conglomerates have to get your word out and to connect with the kind of people who need to see what you're doing and think about it. So that was the link we were trying to make something more of. So what we did with MediaRights.org first was we aggregated all the distributors of social issue documentaries around the country. And this was also very fragmented. There's a lot of independent distributors, educational in general. Currently, we have over 70 distributors of social issue documentaries, all findable on our website. It's the only place you can find all of them. And they have a wealth of fascinating documentaries made in the last 30 years. So, for example, if you had wanted, before there was the internet, if you had wanted to find a documentary about criminal justice to use in your organization that was dealing with something specifically about prisons, you basically would have had to take out like an offline paper catalog and flip through it until you found the name of something that maybe some friend had mentioned to you. Or you'd have to know about it specifically and know how to get it. So that's what I mean by fragmented. What we try to do with Media Rights is the documentaries are organized by filmmaker and title, but also by topic. So you can open, and there's 19 different topics and subtopics. So you can click on criminal justice and type in filmmaker or title, but also topic, and dozens of documentaries from distributors all over the country, some of them self-distributed by the filmmaker, are available, and you can learn how to buy them, how to get a hold of it. So that's the first big step, and that took a lot of work to get that going. So that was the first idea, is let's just make them more available. The second major thing that we try to do with Media Rights, and this is what we've been working on for the last couple of years, is then once people can get a hold of those documentaries, how can they make a bigger impact? And how can they advance the social issues that is what we all care about and the reason we're making the films and trying to see them in the first place? And so we have a variety of ways of trying to do that. One of our showcases for idea to sort of set up the idea of how social issue documentaries can have an impact is that we have this annual festival. We just had our third annual festival called the Media That Matters Film Festival. And it's an alternative and online film festival. And I'm going to show you some clips from it in a moment. We have a jury that selects 12 shorts that are specifically directed to a social issue. It's everything from a public service announcement to some new media to a 12-minute video. And each film, in addition to raising an issue and bringing it to light in a new and interesting creative way, it also is directed to a specific set of actions that a citizen can take to try to get involved either in learning more about it or really trying to make a difference on that issue. So on the website, once the film festival is up, and like Sally Jo was saying, with the number of young people who are on the internet even more than on TV, you can watch it on your computer if you have that capacity, which more and more people do. And then there's a take action link right next to the video after you've screened it, which you can click on, and it links to the social issue organizations that either the filmmaker worked with or that are working on that specific issue to make a difference so they can get involved directly. So now I just want to show you the beginning of a little video. I'm just going to introduce it since I won't show you the whole thing because I don't have the time. It's a video made by a California-based filmmaker named Gabriel London, and it's called No Escape Prison Rape. It's several minutes long. I'm just going to show you the first couple minutes. And it's about a juvenile delinquent who was 16 years old and had some prior convictions. He set fire to a dumpster in the alley behind his house, and because of his prior convictions, was sent to an adult prison where he had a terrible experience. And it had an incredible impact, the video did, which I'll tell you about after I've shown you the first couple minutes. This is just the intro to the festival that's also online. What you're watching here is the DVD, so it doesn't have the take action links. It's just the actual media. But there's special features in the DVD where you can find that information. So I recommend you all check out the website to see how the take action links work. We're working on the audio here. The other thing I was going to tell you about this festival is not only is it online, and then we have this DVD that we're distributing free around the country. And I actually have a few more copies. I put some outside, but I have a few more here, so if you want them, just come up to me afterwards and I can give you some. It's also broadcast on Free Speech TV. And yeah, go ahead and go into... Okay, so let me talk about some other things while they figure out this sound problem. Unless, right, do you think I'll say? Should I go on? I'll just talk about some stuff. It's going to be great when you see it, though. So it's worth waiting for. I kind of want to tell you the end of the story, but I feel like for dramatic narrative purposes, I'm just going to hold off. One of the changes we've made this year, which is actually an important trend, one of the things we're trying to do is always respond to what's happening in how activists and media are connecting and try to enhance that more. And what we've noticed in the last couple of years, partly through the film festival, actually, and the submissions we're getting, is that we're getting more and more work made by youth. And there's really a... Oh, cool. All right. I'll get more on that later. So not this one, though. This is an awesome film, but it's too long. I'm not showing it to you. It's called Vision Test, and it won our special prize. But don't get distracted. We're not going to watch it.
You can see all these on the DVD.
Thanks. So that goes on for several more minutes. Essentially, what happened was he committed suicide in prison. His social worker was never able to help him. This video was made in conjunction with Human Rights Watch that had an entire website devoted to the problems of prison rape all around the country. This video is a story that takes place in Texas, but it's a problem all over the country. Certainly, I'm sure you know, in California has the largest and most overcrowded prison system in the country. As a result of this video, which Gabriel was very devoted to and showed all over the country and which we are helping distribute, U.S. Congress actually got to see it last summer, and it led to the first time a government body has ever acknowledged and taken action on this issue with the Prison Rape Reduction Act of 2003. And it continues to, he's continuing to travel around the country and speak with it, and we're distributing it around the country as well through the film festival. So that's the kind of thing where with a short film like this, without the link to the Human Rights Watch website and the Center on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, it could just be a project that Gabriel did and a couple people saw it, and it wouldn't really have that kind of impact. So that's the kind of steps that we're trying to help facilitate happening. Just on a totally different, to show you the use of humor, also in video, I'm just going to show you a very short piece that was commissioned by the Latino Public Broadcasting Corporation and won our diversity award that's called Is My Neighbor Latino? And it's 1 minute long. So that was, I think it may go without saying, but also almost all of these videos are extremely low-budget videos, and this one was one of our lowest-budget videos that was made by Jorge Aguirre in his backyard with some friends. And again, through the film festival exposure and the links on the site, it's having a much larger life than it would have otherwise. Back to what I was just saying before during our technical difficulty, that youth media has grown enormously in the last several years. Some of you may know about this, and many, many more of our submissions every year are actually made entirely by youth, often without even any assistance of an adult at their youth media after school session or something like that. And it's it's a really important part of what's going on in the sort of intersection of new media and traditional media today that I just hope you're all aware of and stay involved in and follow. I mean, part of the way we feel about it is that, you know, young people are really angry about the world around them, and they're just incredibly creative and resourceful using the tools at their disposal to talk about what it is they want to say. And they use the internet, and they use a camera they found lying around, and if anybody can show them how to use it well, they come up with brilliant creative ways to do it. We have one of the programmers from the Human Rights Watch Film Festival who sits on our jury every year, and she always says, I always think the youth media stuff is the best. You know, it's just incredible the kind of things they can do. So we actually now have a branch of our website that's specifically a youth media geared towards youth site called the Youth Media Distribution Initiative, or YMDI.org, and it has workshops for how youth can become more sophisticated about their distribution strategies, among other things. So finally, I know there's... I should stop. We have a whole bunch of other things we do to try to think about different ways, like I said, to... There's not one way for media to have an impact. There's a lot of great offline strategies that filmmakers and social issue organizations they're partnering with do together. We have workshops on our website that are targeted to different groups. There's a specific work, they're all online and free on the website, that educators and librarians can use to think about how to use social issue media differently for activists and nonprofits, and then also for the filmmakers themselves to think about what happens after I finish the film. So finally, I just want to get back to our original purpose for doing this and why we think this is so important is that I know a lot of you work on digital divide issues, and we feel that media is part of the digital divide, and that if that's left out, it's just a huge missed opportunity. And so we always want to find other ways to sort of get involved in those kinds of things. And we're starting to address these needs, although there's, you know, the more we learn, the more we wish we could have 8 different programs for all the different good ideas people have about how to make an impact. But we're helping nonprofits use media strategically in ways that maybe they hadn't before, and also just trying to figure out how many partnerships we can make between media makers and filmmakers and how many creative ways. So thank you very much. And I'll be around later if you want some videos or information.
Thank you, Katie. Next, I'd like to ask for Malkia Cyril to speak. Malkia is with the Youth Media Council, which is a 16-member, it has 16 member organizations and leads a community-based coalition for media accountability.
Good morning. First of all, I want to say thank you for having me speak to you today. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how young people are using media to move from the margins to the center by fighting for media justice. So we can all agree that we live in a free market economy, yes? Okay. Now, we may not all agree that that economy and the dynamics of capital use race and gender to stratify people for profit, but we have lots of evidence of that all over the place, right? In the school system, the fact that our folks are being tracked into prisons, gentrification, it's everywhere. And not just in the United States, it's all over the world. So in that kind of an environment, what does the media act like? In our assessment, the media acts more as a bullhorn for government instead of a watchdog, like it's supposed to, while simultaneously maximizing corporate interests. Now, that's a dangerous combination for everybody involved, but especially for those who are poor, brown, female, gay, activists, immigrants, and youth. I'm going to tell you a story that you've probably already heard. How many people know about all the stuff that happened at the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas? People heard about that? So a lot of funders got shot with rubber bullets. A lot of journalists got shot. People got hit with flash grenades. They were pepper sprayed. Folks were sexually assaulted by police officers. There were illegal searches. There were illegal detentions. Did you read about that in the news? What I read about was the heroic efforts of the Miami Police Department. And those stories were written by journalists embedded with the Miami Police Department. As media becomes more consolidated and corporate controlled, this phenomenon of blatant media bias is becoming more familiar to more people. But for people like me and people in my community and other marginalized people, the story is very old. For many of us, citizenship and democracy are key concepts when we think about the media and media engagement. But we all experience citizenship and democracy very differently. For example, since the 1800s, the media has been used to both target people of color and exclude them. It hasn't just acted as a portal for civic engagement, the way it may have for some. In the 80s, we had the war on drugs. In the 90s, we had the war on crime and the emergence of the war on youth with policies like zero tolerance and California's Proposition 21. And today, we have a war on terrorism. Drugs, crime, youth, and terrorists have become the primary mechanisms for coded public debate about race. Using distorted and unfair representation of marginalized communities to de-racialize racism is one trend that I want to bring to your attention today. In 2003, this is what the OPD had to say about youth. A lot of people have examined coverage of youth, and everyone that's examined coverage of youth has found the same things. Most of the coverage of youth is crime coverage. News media report violent youth crime out of proportion to its actual occurrence. News media mentions when the youth crime rate goes up, but it doesn't mention when it goes down. Pets and animals are more newsworthy than youth poverty and education. The voices of youth, especially youth of color, are all but absent from coverage, while white adults are the primary spokespeople in coverage of youth. Violence against youth by adults is undercovered, especially when the victims are black. Punishment is the primary solution offered in coverage of youth crime. With these images, we find many trends going on. We think that these images serve three purposes. One, as scapegoats, we're blamed for the failure of social policy. Two, as scarecrows, we provide the subtext of fear to promote dangerous policy like worldwide war. And three, as sex symbols, our culture is used to sell ideas and values that package agendas that hurt everybody. So, what do we need? Well, there's a great media reform movement on the rise, which I encourage every one of you to support. But a trend that I want to bring to your attention is the emergence of a media reform movement that does not include us all. If we want peace, a just economy, a fair system of law and government, we need to force media to be the watchdog and portal for civic engagement it's supposed to be for everybody. We need a media that's regulated by a truly democratic government, not just a democratic media. We need a media that's owned by the people it serves and accountable to the world that it influences. But reforming the media without acknowledging its history and role is like putting a Band-Aid on a migraine. It just don't work. Media justice is a new concept that's coming up that I want you all to know about. And it means to us a radical transformation of the current system of communications led by marginalized people with a vision of creating racial, economic, and gender justice. So that's our vision. That's some history, context, and trends. So how do we do it? Well, I'm going to tell you how we do it, and then y'all can figure out how you want to do it. The Youth Media Council is a youth organizing, leadership development, media capacity building, and watchdog organization that's dedicated to developing culturally relevant media justice strategies for marginalized people. At the Youth Media Council, we use culture as an organizing tool, pressure and strategic media coordination as key strategies, speaking for ourselves as our central principle, and media justice as our guiding analysis. We believe that building media capacity regionally helps to centralize tools, popularize trainings, and engages organizations in their own media markets. So we have a membership base of actually 20 youth organizations, because we just got more, which I'm very happy about. And we provide training, tools, and relationships to those members with journalists. We also think that statewide media coordination amplifies the progressive voice of the youth movement around policy issues that might otherwise never reach the newsroom. As a minority, I'm going to talk a little bit about California now, so give you a little bit of an example of what I mean by that. As a minority-majority state with a history of precedent-setting propositions, California plays a key role in shaping the national debate around race and is currently positioned to shape a national conversation around electoral issues in the upcoming presidential election. One of the things that that we think, one of the ideas that we hold true, is that we believe that working in one state, I'm gonna let you read that for a second. But we believe basically that working in one region and in one state, particularly key states like California, can influence the dynamics all around the country. And that's what we hope to do. Another thing that we do is we support key campaigns that we believe will highlight racial and economic justice in the youth movement agenda. For example, we're currently working with an organization called APAL, Asian Youth Promoting Advocacy and Leadership, around the anti-deportation campaign. We're providing them with PR support, media work, and doing it as a media capacity building campaign for the specific and explicit purpose of highlighting the racial and economic justice elements of deportation, of an anti-deportation campaign. We believe that opposing deportation is key in this particular political climate. So that's the kind of way that we would choose that campaign. And we think that just as one region or state can impact the nation, we think one constituency can also impact multitudes of constituencies. For example, though the civil rights movement primarily created gains for black people, the victories echoed for everybody. The media strategies that were used in the civil rights movement profoundly shaped the victories, and the images of that movement last with us to this day. We believe the same thing can be true for the youth movement that is blossoming both here in California and across the country. Another trend that I want to point out is the use of fear to sell dangerous policy and to make money. Today, consolidated corporate media and unaccountable administrations rely heavily on loaded images of youth to fulfill their interests. When the media misrepresent young people of color, deny them access to speak for themselves, and the FCC erases accountability mechanisms, the impact is that we're jailed by the thousands, we lose our basic services, or we die. So here we are in a key state, with a key constituency, using new strategies against new targets. 60 years ago, movements relied on governments to legislate victories. Today, we know that governments are bound to corporate power, and power-building strategies for corporate accountability are necessary. So what are we doing about that? Well, one of the things we're doing is that the Youth Media Council is organizing against media corporations like Clear Channel, and focusing on local urban hip-hop stations like KMEL and local news outlets like KTVU as a way to make the commodification of culture and information relevant to marginalized stakeholders. We use the mediums of art and culture in our actions and outreach to pressure targets and build a base in our own authentic voice. Through our media accountability campaigns and participation in a national media justice network, spearheaded by Third World Majority and a bunch of other folks, the Youth Media Council is engaging marginalized youth as a new constituency, fighting for media justice with our own voices, in our own way, and with a new vision. 2/3 of the public say they make decisions about important policy issues based on information they get from the media. From the FTAA to the streets of the Bay, media is a life and death issue for marginalized people. In the next several years, as has been true for the past several years, America's youth will face war, increasing unemployment, budget cuts, longer jail sentences, more police brutality. But luckily for the world, luckily for me, Luckily for you, young people will continue to use the media skills they gain to raise their voices, expose the lies, make room for truth, and organize for peace and justice. With PR tools, relationship-building opportunities for youth organizations and reporters, the Youth Media Council will be right there with them to support. As the youth movement builds a social base for a larger progressive agenda, reframing public debate about youth policy and translating electoral issues into social ones, coverage and policies will change. We may not all be able to vote, but we can influence the vote through strategic and coordinated media work. Finally, we believe that through successful media work, we can gain control of the terms of debate and strengthen a national movement. What can you do? Well, in our opinion, you can fund the strategic communications work of grassroots organizations around key racial and economic justice campaigns. You can support media coordination amongst pre-existing networks. You can encourage organizing groups to make media policy a secondary issue to whatever their primary issue is. You can invest in media accountability organizing campaigns of marginalized groups as pilot projects. The Ford Foundation recently made a grant to the funding exchange, and that's called the Media Justice Fund. And that specifically is for pilot projects of groups that are taking on the question of media policy, new constituencies taking on the question of media policy. I encourage that as a strategy. Learn about media justice and support the upcoming Media Justice Summit that's coming up in August. We need your help, but we also want to help you, because when we build together, then we all win. We want to gather the resources that we need to create a world in which all communities have the power and means to debate policy, create alternatives, share information, and shape culture on our own terms. When marginalized people win, we all win. Thank you.
Well, I have a slideshow here just to give some images to keep along. There's a lot of material to cover, and so much to say, but I'm very honored to be here, and thank you for having me as a start. Now, many of you are probably aware of what Move On is. There we are. We're a grassroots organization. We have over 1.6 million members here in the U.S. Better? Okay, thank you. So we have over 1.6 million members here in the U.S., and what we're trying to do is help people engage in the political dialogue, and we've been amazed at what an incredible tool the internet is to do that. And I'm told this is a form of media, too. So we started actually 5 years ago with the impeachment scandal, and what happened is Wes and I put together a one-sentence petition asking the Congress to immediately censure President Clinton and move on to pressing issues facing the nation, and sent out to under 100 of our friends and families. And this is the growth in the first 4 days. We had 100,000 people sign this petition within the first week. And all of a sudden, we were on a very fast learning curve about how to help these people express their concerns about the direction we were taking. And just to give you a sense of it, these are some of the things that happened with that first petition. It did grow to 500,000. Whenever we had people sign a petition, they'd sign the petition, we'd get their zip code, so we could always let them know their representative's name and phone number when they needed a call. And we talked to the local and national press, and we had this huge network of people that were talking to the local and national press. We delivered petitions in Washington, D.C., huge boxes of them, to the representatives in a media event, a press event. And we encouraged members to write letters to the editor. We also had constituent meetings in district in over 250 representatives' offices, and that was organized in a week. And of course, when the election came along in November, we encouraged voter registration. We helped get out the vote, and we were, in fact, overjoyed after the election in November of 1998, because we thought a very strong point had been made that impeachment was not popular. But nonetheless, our representatives voted to impeach about 2 weeks later, and the list, that's when the list grew another 200,000 people. And from there, we decided that full engagement is to communicate with your leadership, and when they do not reflect your values, the next thing you have to do is get involved in the electoral process. And we became a PAC and raised over $2 million in the 2000 election for candidates. And the average contribution was $35, which, you know, when you start looking at the influence of large corporations and the problem with influence of the grassroots, really starts to speak to the capacity for grassroots to have a powerful voice and for candidates to be able to run without special interest money. It hasn't been possible. So, is the internet a different kind of media? I certainly think it is, and I think we're learning the ways it's different, you know, as I speak and as we go on. Broadcast media is a one-way communication where they're talking to you. They're telling a story. And what the internet offers when it's used best is two-way communication, dialogue. We have thousands and thousands of emails from our members every week. We have an online reader-rated discussion forum, which means that people can put comments in, they can rate those comments, and the best comments rise to the top, and it gives us an ability to have a sense of our members' passions. Tens of thousands of people can participate, and we have a better gauge. We also use surveys, and fundamentally, for us to succeed as an online organizer, we have to be listening very well. And that last note there about the internet being responsive, the other thing that is wonderful about the internet is if our message isn't good, we know within an hour and we can change it. So being flexible is one of the beauties of the internet, if you're able to work with that. Okay, so our first experience of growth, what I would describe as viral growth, was with the Clinton impeachment scandal. Our next experience with viral growth was the war with Iraq. That was the point in which we grew to about 1.2, 1.3 million members here in the U.S. We're over 2 million members worldwide. And this graph basically just shows you all the many different things we did during that lead up to the war. And you'll note that whenever we engaged, we grew. And that is one of the messages that I've been going out and talking to organizations about. Win, lose, or draw, if you engage, you get stronger. And that's certainly been our experience, and we believe that's true for most groups, that what we need to do is give people the opportunity to engage. Now, just so you get a little sense of what kind of engagement. These are pictures from Senate meetings. We had meetings in Senate offices around the country in August of last year, and people delivered petitions to their senators personally, which is a very powerful experience for, you know, the staffers, because you normally do meet with staff, but also for the people going there. You see that these are not the usual suspects arriving, and it becomes a much more real experience for everybody. Now, the other thing we learned during the Iraq campaign was that people are ready to pay for media. We wanted to put this ad in the New York Times. We put out a request to our members. we were hoping to raise $25,000. And we were blown away. We got $400,000. So we definitely put the ad in. We put it in USA Today and other, but we also did a TV ad. We did the Daisy ad, which was not a huge ad buy, but it got incredible attention on the news as well. So in terms of our media strategy, we always try and also have that free media, which is in many ways even more powerful than the advertisement part of that media campaign. And we also did radio, and we did billboard, and we did local newspaper ads. People wanted to be heard, and they were ready to pay to be heard. And once again, you have an average contribution by members of about $35 for these advertisements. So given the opportunity to participate in what seems like a meaningful way, people will step forward, and they will do what it takes to get it out there. Now, we also organized a worldwide vigil that was a remarkable event. And I thought this was a wonderful quote from the New York Times that happened around this time. "The fracturing of the Western alliance over Iraq and the huge anti-war demonstrations around the world this weekend are reminders that there may still be two superpowers on the planet, the United States and world opinion." I think that's what gives me the most optimism, is I see that people want to engage, and there are ways for people to engage very, very broadly. Essentially, the internet can be also perceived as a really incredible phone tree. You know, we have a message that we need to get out. We can get it out within 24 hours to over a million people. And what's better yet, during the build-up to Iraq, the Win Without War Coalition came together. And this coalition included the National Council of Churches, the NAACP, unions, NOW, the Sierra Club, the breadth of organizations that came together on the same page about this issue was amazing. And I see very much these same organizations coming together going forward into the coming election year. And they are also doing online organizing. The AFL-CIO has over 1.2 million members. I think it's the Environmental Defense Fund, 500,000, Planned Parenthood, 400,000. You know, you start doing the math, and yeah, we're just little. We're going to become just one of many. So I think there is a huge opportunity for helping people engage on deeper levels. Now, something we discovered after the Iraq campaign was over is that people are ready to advertise on other issues, even beyond the issue of Iraq. We didn't know if the passion extended, but they did. And this is about a school that was doing a blood drive, public school that needed money, and the parents were giving blood, which we thought was a little egregious when they're doing tax cuts. This next one is an ad that our members funded that when we were opposing the relaxation of the FCC regulations. And I do believe that having gone through the whole experience of leading into the war with Iraq, our members understood in a much deeper way than they previously would have how important having independent media is, and diversity in outlets. And you know, in this particular ad, the poor guy there just keep on seeing Rupert face on every channel. It's a painful ad. It's really hard to look at. But, so, you know, to speak more about one of the issues we're looking at here, I thought this was an amazing research piece. A program on international policy attitudes and knowledge networks revealed a disturbing breadth of public misperceptions in October. 80% of Fox viewers believed one of the following non-facts. The United States uncovered evidence demonstrating a close working relationship between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. 2, weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq. 3, most people in other countries backed the U.S. war against Saddam Hussein. 45% of Fox viewers believed all 3 of these facts. Now, my problem with this is if we're going to have a national political discussion and we're not even working with the same facts, we've got serious problems. Move On members we have about 30,000 Move On members that have joined something we call the Media Corps, and we are trying our best to find ways to give the mainstream media direct feedback when they go outside of what we consider accurate factual reporting. And that includes calling people up. We're looking at tactics and we're trying a lot of different things. But Fox News is one of the most egregious in putting forth news that is more like propaganda. So,
oh, that's nice that my.
Okay, so our first experience of growth, what I would describe as viral growth, was with the Clinton impeachment scandal. Our next experience with viral growth was the war with Iraq. That was the point in which we grew to about 1.2, 1.3 million members here in the U.S. We're over 2 million members worldwide. And this graph basically just shows you all the many different things we did during that lead up to the war. And you'll note that whenever we engaged, we grew. And that is one of the messages that I've been going out and talking to organizations about. Win, lose, or draw, if you engage, you get stronger. And that's certainly been our experience, and we believe that's true for most groups, that what we need to do is give people the opportunity to engage. Now, just so you get a little sense of what kind of engagement, these are pictures from Senate meetings. We had meetings in Senate offices around the country in August of last year, and people delivered petitions to their senators personally, which is a very powerful experience for, you know, the staffers, because you normally do meet with staff, but also for the people going there. You see that these are not the usual suspects arriving, and it becomes a much more real experience for everybody. Now, the other thing we learned during the Iraq campaign was that people are ready to pay for media. We wanted to put this ad in the New York Times. We put out a request to our members. We were hoping to raise $25,000. And we were blown away. We got $400,000. So we definitely put the ad in. We put it in USA Today and others. But we also did a TV ad. We did the Daisy ad, which was not a huge ad buy, but it got incredible attention on the news as well. So in terms of our media strategy, we always try and also have that free media, which is in many ways even more powerful than the advertisement part of that media campaign. And we also did radio, and we did billboard, and we did local newspaper ads. People wanted to be heard, and they were ready to pay to be heard. And once again, you have an average contribution by members of about $35 for these advertisements. So given the opportunity to participate in what seems like a meaningful way, people will step forward and they will do what it takes to get it out there. Now, we also organized a worldwide vigil that was a remarkable event. And I thought this was a wonderful quote from the New York Times that happened around this time. The fracturing of the Western alliance over Iraq and the huge anti-war demonstrations around the world this weekend are reminders that there may still be 2 superpowers on the planet, the United States and world opinion. I think that's what gives me the most optimism, is I see that people want to engage, and there are ways for people to engage very, very broadly. essentially, the internet can be also perceived as a really incredible phone tree. You know, we have a message that we need to get out. We can get it out within 24 hours to over a million people. And what's better yet, during the build-up to Iraq, the Win Without War Coalition came together. And this coalition included the National Council of Churches, the NAACP, unions, NOW, the Sierra Club, the breadth of organizations that came together on the same page about this issue was amazing. And I see very much these same organizations coming together going forward into the coming election year. And they are also doing online organizing. The AFL-CIO has over 1.2 million members. I think it's the Environmental Defense Fund, 500,000, Planned Parenthood, 400,000. You know, you start doing the math, and yeah, we're just little. We're going to become just one of many. So I think there is a huge opportunity for helping people engage on deeper levels. Now, something we discovered after the Iraq campaign was over is that people are ready to advertise on other issues, even beyond the issue of Iraq. We didn't know if the passion extended, but they did. And this is about a school that was doing a blood drive, public school that needed money, and the parents were giving blood, which we thought was a little egregious when they're doing tax cuts. This next one is an ad that our members funded that when we were opposing the relaxation of the FCC regulations. And I do believe that having gone through the whole experience of leading into the war with Iraq, our members understood in a much deeper way than they previously would have how important having independent media is and diversity in outlets. And you know, in this particular ad, the poor guy there just keep on seeing Rupert face on every channel. It's a painful ad. It's really hard to look at. Okay. So, you know, to speak more about one of the issues we're looking at here, I thought this was an amazing research piece. A program on international policy attitudes and knowledge networks revealed a disturbing breadth of public misperceptions in October. 80% of Fox viewers believed one of the following non-facts. The United States uncovered evidence demonstrating a close working relationship between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. 2, weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq. 3, most people in other countries backed the U.S. war against Saddam Hussein. 45% of Fox viewers believed all 3 of these facts. Now, my problem with this is if we're going to have a national political discussion and we're not even working with the same facts, we've got serious problems. Move On members we have about 30,000 Move On members that have joined something we call the Media Corps, and we are trying our best to find ways to give the mainstream media direct feedback when they go outside of what we consider accurate factual reporting. And that includes calling people up. We're looking at tactics and we're trying a lot of different things. But Fox News is one of the most egregious in putting forth news that is more like propaganda. So,
oh, that's nice that my battery's charged. Okay.
So. Stuck. Let's go out of here for a minute. Excuse me. It won't play with me. You may not get to see the rest if I don't succeed at this.
It's not... The power said it was fully charged. It is just...
Yeah, that's what I'm hitting.
Freeze.
Not escape. It's freezing and it's not going to the next one. Yeah, if you could take a look, that would be much appreciated. Okay, how am I doing on time?
There you go. We're back.
Great, thank you. But we need it to go places. Now, we are continuing to do advertising. We found, actually, we have a lovely holiday ad that has just started airing, kind of a yes, big contributors, there is a Santa Claus, talking about Halberton and shows Santa.
Is that it?
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. Let's hope it goes both ways. And they just discovered that Santa happens to be at the White House wearing cowboy boots, so I hope you get a chance to see it. We have done something. We took on a really big project a couple months ago. We started a 527, and we're going to be doing national advertising with a special emphasis in swing states. And we're trying to raise $10 million, and we've already raised $7 million. And then what's even more incredible than that, at about $3 million, George Soros and Peter Lewis came in and gave us matching funds. So we had small contributors bringing in big contributors, which are bringing in more small contributors, which I think is a beautiful combination of getting things done. And we are running these ads. They are first getting the national exposure, and because we do have now Move On members doing publicity, PR now, locally in all these marketplaces. We have about 150 groups we've identified and we're trying to organize. We're doing our best to get the news side, and then we're going deep in these particular swing markets, and we are doing research, testing the ads before and after, before we buy deep. Because we do believe using objective standards to determine whether the ad is actually achieving what we're hoping it to is really important. Now, what you see up here is something else that we're doing that is just really fun. We launched a Bush in 30 Seconds ad contest because we've got this incredible membership of talented, talented people. And we've received over 1,000. The ad contest is over. I'm sorry you can't join it. But we've gotten over 1,000 ads. They're amazing. They're going to be judged. We've got famous stars judging, Al Franken, Jessica Lange, Michael Mann, and lots of others, Michael Moore. And there'll be a big event in New York City where the winner is announced, and then that winning ad will be played around the time of the State of the Union address. And I'm thinking that we may I want to play all the ads, frankly, but I think we'll find ways to do more than just that one. But we'll also have found this wonderful base of talent. Something else I should be talking about is, we're talking about independent films, and we had house parties last Sunday in over 2,400 houses viewing Robert Greenwald's film Uncovered about, the lead up to the Iraq War and fundamentally the ongoing misperceptions that the administration kept putting forward. And it was very powerful. And this is a quote by Don Hazen of Alternate, noting that as the presidential election moves closer, Move On's revolutionary potential lies not in buying advertising space from media corporations, but rather in its ability to circumvent the corporate media with quality content that could potentially turn many of its nearly 2 million members and the larger group they influence, potentially 10 million or more, into viral marketers and perhaps more. Now, there were over 50,000 people altogether watching that film, and then they went out and they're taking it further. And I think we will do more house parties. And so he talks about the growth of the internet spawning a new class of super communicators.
individuals who have listservs, blogs, and are the viral revolutionaries carrying the message of Move On, and many progressive websites. And I think those many progressive websites is a very important message, because as all these different organizations start to work with the internet as well as other traditional ways they have to get people involved, I think we're going to have a really powerful grassroots movement. And I think Howard Dean is also an excellent example of a politician that has blown people away by using the grassroots and getting people involved. And what makes it powerful is this two-way communication that is possible. So, thank you very much. I'll be on the panel there.